The superintendent's episode you're about to hear was recorded in San Diego, California as part of the AASA conference. AASA brings district and school leaders from across the country together for important conversations about what they're doing in their districts, the results they're having, the results they're not having, and how we can all work together to make sure that every child can succeed in school. These conversations were heartfelt, they were interesting, they were open and candid, and I cannot thank the superintendents who are a part of it enough. From the Fort Worth ISD superintendent who told me that in her district, she's not just the superintendent, but she's also the largest employer, the largest restaurant, and the largest place of transportation. I was absolutely floored to, you know, really have that put in front of me. And to the LAUSD superintendent who told us some real hard truths about staffing and about the different things that are happening for teachers and leaders across the country. We had so many leaders stop to talk with us. There are many episodes because they had places to be and conversations to have, but these were inspiring and we're so excited to share them with you. Thanks for being here on More Than a Test.
This is Laura Glad with Amira Learning and More Than a Test, and we are still here at AASA. This afternoon, we're here with Scott. And Scott, why don't you tell us a little bit about your district and what leadership looks like there?
Sure. Thank you for having me. My name is Scott Evislog. I'm the superintendent of schools in the Haprell-Horsham School District, which is a suburban school district in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
We have around 4,300 students, six schools, one high school, one middle school, four elementary schools.
Great. Okay, so suburban Pennsylvania. I'll tell you, my mom is from Kimberton, Pennsylvania, so like Dutch country and stuff like that. When you say suburbs, is it like a real suburbs? Because I picture kind of farmland out there. Is that...
Well, Haprell-Horsham is located in Montgomery County,
okay.
Which is just north of the city. It is the most highly populated Philadelphia suburban county.
Okay.
And one of the wealthier suburban counties.
And are you from there?
I wasn't born there. I was born in Minnesota.
Okay.
But did most of my schooling. My family relocated to the Philadelphia area. So from fifth grade on, I've been in the Philadelphia area both and all through college as well.
Yeah. I've talked to a surprising number of superintendents, assistant superintendents from Minnesota. Are they just like growing leaders out in Minnesota?
Well, I come from a family of educators, so there are a lot of educators in my family that were teachers and principals, superintendents in Minnesota.
Okay.
So I don't know if there's something in the water there, but it's certainly part of our family and my experience is certainly very formative. My relationship with my educator relatives.
And I assume you started as a teacher.
I did. I was a special education teacher and then transitioned into school leadership as an assistant principal. And then I was a middle and high school principal before being an assistant superintendent for curriculum instruction and then transitioning to the superintendent role in 2020.
And you've done all the roles, it sounds like.
I've worn a few different hats. Yeah, I mean, it's been, I think it helps I know there's a lot of paths to the superintendency, certainly biased in my perspective of having the curriculum instruction path. But I also feel as if my time as a special educator has been really impactful to my work as a superintendent.
So the Orange County superintendent told me that the hardest job she ever did was being a K-8 principal. And she's the superintendent of the eighth largest district in the country. When you think about all the roles that you took on, is the superintendent the hardest job?
I mean, each job has its challenges.
Right.
I thought as a 21, 22-year-old teacher that I was teaching emotional support students in an alternative setting.
Okay.
And that was very challenging. I grew a lot in that role.
Right.
I'd say it's probably as challenging as any role that I ever had. But I also feel it helped shape me a lot as an educator.
That's really great. I appreciate that. Okay, so one of the things superintendents have said in that chair today is that what's been great about being here is you have this community of people who are all having the same experience, right? Or at least some version of it. And so as a result, you can commiserate in some cases. Can you think of something that you're all kind of, or that you've experienced a commiseration around the last couple of days where you have a community for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, I think we've developed that type of network in our county at home with a very, very collaborative group of superintendents and colleagues that we communicate frequently. But being here on the national stage is a whole different, provides a whole different perspective. And I think it's both comforting and reassuring, supporting to hear that there's, you know, some common challenges that we're facing. and also to really get a sense of how different some of the school settings are across the country. I mean, the challenges that rural superintendents in the South, for example, have is very different from our experience. But that doesn't mean there aren't plenty of lessons that I can learn from them. So the opportunity to connect with those across the country has been, it's been a wonderful experience.
What's a challenge that you're facing that you came here hoping for some support solutions on?
We're going through some strategic planning and some visioning in our community, and have been in some sessions where we talk about the power of communication and collaboration and working to really find the voice and vision for our community to bring forward. It's been a chance to sense some of those commonalities across some districts, but also to hone in on what's unique in our own community.
Right.
And so that's been, I think, one of the things that I've gained from being here that I'll be able to take back home. There's certainly answers here. There's answers for you know, how we're working through some mental health challenges, how we're working through fiscal and other challenges that most districts are facing. Connecting with others certainly helps.
Yeah, that's amazing. I don't think I've heard yet today. I know I've heard a lot about commiserating, but I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that they had solutions that are helping them here. Yeah. And I think that that's really powerful and amazing. You mentioned, you know, thinking about what makes your community unique. What makes your community unique for you?
I think that we're in a district, in a community that's gone through some demographic and political change over the last 10 to 12 years, but has also maintained a true sense of local pride. And so there's a lot of pride in our community. We're the Happer Horsham Hatters, which is our mascot. And so there's a lot of Hatter pride in our community that we really feel is pretty special to what we provide for kids and what we provide for one another. Every community has its own little identity, but we're certainly proud of ours. And I think that makes us pretty unique.
That is unique. Okay, so let's switch gears to academics. When you think about your priorities as a district for academics, what's the area of focus for next year or for the upcoming years?
Certainly some equity-minded goals about ensuring we're closing some gaps around access to higher-level courses, ensuring that we have every student is having rigorous coursework and pathways to career and post-secondary opportunities. We're really looking at measuring those academic indicators K-12, try to close some of those gaps.
Right.
Because we want our graduates to have choices when they leave us.
Yeah.
So that's been a primary focus for us. Our strategic planning is helping us move in that direction.
Something that's come up a lot is that in AP classes, advanced courses, there's a concern that access is the problem, that there are these hoops, especially in suburban districts and wealthy districts, that kids at the bottom kind of have these hoops to jump through to get into these classes that they're perfectly capable of taking once we give them the opportunity. Is that something that you're managing?
Yeah, we're very much invested in that.
Yeah.
And not only breaking down some of the barriers of what may have prevented students from enrolling in classes, but ensuring that they're successful once they're there.
Yeah.
A lot of times kids just need an invitation, right? They need to hear from an adult that you can be successful here, and they need to feel from their peers, from their colleagues, and from the teachers and adults around them that they can be successful in that setting.
Right.
In almost all cases, kids rise to the occasion and they show us what they're capable of. And we know that asking more of them is a good thing for them.
Yeah.
And then providing them support to help them get there.
That's awesome. That's really great. All right. I asked two questions of every single guest. Let me ask you the best advice you've ever been given.
Be humble and ask good questions. Don't make it about yourself. Make it about the kids, but ask the questions that are going to help push you and push your community in a way that's going to really benefit students.
I have a woman who works for me. Her name is Megan, and she asks the best questions. And I have seen her just totally excel and do amazing things because of her amazing questions. So I love that you said that. And one book you think everyone should read?
Ted Dintersmith's book about what school could be.
Okay, I haven't read it yet.
And that was an opportunity for us in school. I mean, it was powerful for us to be able to read examples of what a common meaning, not meaning in any derogatory way, but just, a school district like ourselves or like any other, what are things that they're doing that are actionable to think about what education, how education can really be different for kids?
Yeah.
So that was a book that I think really was impactful for us.
That's incredible. Well, thank you so much for being here. Thanks for spending some time with us. I know you're busy and just off of lunch, so this is a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, this is Laura Glab with Amira Learning, and I'm here in San Diego. We've been here all day. We're jumping in to After Lunch with Aaron Bowie III.
That's right.
From Youngstown. You're the head of Chief Academics.
Chief Academic Officer, yes.
Chief Academic Officer. Tell us a little bit about Youngstown.
Well, Youngstown is a former steel-built city. It's up in the northeast corner of Ohio, about an hour from Pittsburgh, an hour from Cleveland. Definitely a blue-collar, hard-working city. You know, I've had steel industry, have the automotive industry, just a city of hardworking folks that are out there to do the best they can every single day.
And how did you end up there?
So I came in hired as a principal of a K-8 elementary building. And 5 years later, I still work in the district.
Okay, so when you look at academics, so your chief academic officer means all academics, K-12, right?
Correct.
And you were a principal of K-8. What did you teach?
Originally, I was a high school special ed teacher with a concentration in math and science.
Okay.
But I also had the elementary teaching degree. So I have an elementary initial degree, a master's in exceptional ed, where I taught children with behavior disorders, primarily the math and science classes, but I ended up teaching it all because you're a special ed teacher.
Wow, that's incredible. But what I wonder about, because I feel like I've had a couple superintendents sit down and talk to me about, you know, programs for high schoolers to get credits for the work they do after school or getting into AP classes. And then I had a few people come in and they talk about science of reading and the foundations of literacy. How do you know what to prioritize when you're dealing with a learning spectrum kindergarten through 12th grade?
I mean, in essence, we always look at literacy as the basic foundational skill.
Okay.
And especially when you're navigating, if you're talking about a high school situation and even CTE prep or CTE preparation, if you can't read the material, read the information,
Right. Read
the application to get into the program, it's one of those initial major barriers to being able to move forward with whatever you do.
Right.
And also knowing that your literacy impacts your ability, your speaking skills. They kind of go hand in hand, and those are very much so prerequisites for what you're going to do in any content area, but definitely any type of career training and career preparation.
So I had an assistant superintendent of academics from South Carolina on earlier. First thing this morning, he came on, and what he said to me was he was really excited because the state had pushed down a lot of science of reading initiatives. I would say Ohio's governor almost led this idea of states really being into science of reading. Has it felt like a great collaboration? Has it felt like you're getting more of what you need from the state office or from the governor's office, or has it felt more mandatey?
So I would say Governor DeWine has definitely led the charge.
Right.
And a lot of us in school districts have appreciated a lot of it. But we have colleagues that have not necessarily appreciated it because it is a top-down methodology of, Unfortunately, sometimes that's how governance goes. But what I would say is, as our district, we were a little bit ahead of the curve.
Okay.
So it's actually just affirmation for some of the work that we've been doing.
Okay.
In regards to we began, when I was first hired into the district, about a year and a half before they started making the transition, just making sure that the literacy-based practices were evidence-based.
Okay.
And based upon research and not anything different, but more specifically, something that worked for Youngstown scholars.
Okay.
High poverty, low achievement over some periods of time. So the district was looking into what are the strategies, what are the methodologies of teaching literacy that we need to do to meet the needs of our students, because some of the other metrics and strategies just weren't working for Youngstown scholars. By the end of it all, Governor DeWine's pushed down the Department of Ed, or now it's the Department of Education and Workforce. They just tried to be a guiding force to say, let's follow highly effective evidence-based practices. We want all of our districts to use it across the state. So, we've walked this lock and step with the state and continue to do the work on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, as someone who leads academics, I'm sure you say and hear the words evidence-based a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience, that means a lot of things to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that it gets stamped on things all the time.
Correct.
When you say, I stand behind this because it's evidence-based, what does that mean to you?
What it means to me is that when I want to use a strategy that works with a particular scholar that fits a demographic group in our district,
mm-hmm.
then I know that I can go and look at the strategy, look up the research behind it to find out what's the sample size,
right,
what's the effect size, but also get into the nature of the evidence, the research that was conducted to find out that, hey, listen, it was across a broad sample size.
Okay.
It met the demographics that match my district. It is highly effective for students with disabilities because it was in a research-based study that was that. So when I say evidence-based, I mean when I get into the tactical elements of the research report, I find things that are consistent or characteristic or attributes that are consistent with high-quality research that actually hits publicized journals that the APA Foundation will support. And it's not just some, okay, there's a $200 study that was paid for by the company, and here are the two or three metrics or elements that they looked at, and the sample size was Asian students who lived in a high wealth area,
right,
born to all professional families.
Right.
That, when I say evidence, I want to know that it is based upon good, sound bits and pieces that look like my students, talk like my students, live in areas like our scholars do.
I think if my CEO was here, he'd give you a hug. I feel like I ask this question a lot and I get a lot of jargon back to hear just like the details of what you look for in an RCT, mm-hmm, to really say that it matters. Like, it means a lot to me. And I think it's incredible that you know that. And I hope that like we can spread that. Let me ask you a totally different question. So again, I said I had the academic officer from South Carolina on this morning, and I asked him right towards the end, like, so like, are you here because you want to be a superintendent? And he said, absolutely not. He said, I know what my superintendent looks like on a Friday afternoon. And so I'm looking at you, it's Friday afternoon and you still look pretty like calm and with it. Is that the goal, is to kind of head
at some point in time? Yes, it is the goal.
Awesome.
It is definitely the goal in the future. When folks and my colleagues at, you know, we're in the AASA cohort for USC, mm-hmm, you know, the Aspiring Urban Superintendents Institute. So
right.
I'm in it to win it, yes.
Right.
Now, timing is very highly dependent. I'm a dad. I'm a husband.
Yeah.
I have a fifth grader, a third grader, and a second grader.
Right.
So my timing for taking that role will be fit on me being a father and a husband first. So right now, I want to raise my kids. I don't want my wife to become a single parent. And the way I look at stuff is when I want to do a job, I want to do it 110% the way it needs to be done.
Right.
So I would struggle to be able to be the kind of father I want to my children.
Yeah.
The husband I want to be to my wife. Well, at the same time, leading a district and putting the children's needs, the teachers' needs, the community's desire for what the organization represents as the priority. So there's a lot of folks that say they want to do it and get into it, and they do it really well. Some folks get in and struggle, and you know, sometimes it's that trade-off and sacrifice in life, and it's what are you willing to sacrifice to do what you want to accomplish.
It's interesting that you say this because, again, we've had a lot of superintendents today, and they're saying, you know, it's a hard job. It seems like you have a pretty good perspective with what you're saying with your family and things like that of just what it takes to do that job. Do you think it's gotten a lot harder in the last few years?
I'd say it has. The nature of our roles as educational leaders is to develop future citizens.
Right.
That the fundamental principle behind education was to develop high quality citizens in our community. Well, unfortunately, as time has gone on, the roles and responsibilities of being a good citizen have only gotten more and more complex.
Right.
School districts are only serving more and more needs and components of what, historically speaking, families were primarily responsible for. So now we're crossing into that threshold of we need to have some critical dialogue with families, with community members to say, listen, my scope of influence is supposed to be educationally based.
Right.
But now we are having to embed social and emotional learning things, ensuring that there's food security.
Right.
There's a lot of issues that are crossing into the schoolhouse that weren't necessarily as influential as they were in the past. So no, it's only getting harder.
Your title only says academic. So do you get to separate out those other things that the kids need and really focus on academics? Or is it becoming just like a stew of things that children need that everyone's got to kind of go in a lot of different directions?
We talk about academics. Somebody or the presenter earlier today said, you know, Maslow before Bloom's.
Right.
So I would love to say, oh, yes, all I have to focus on is the academic pieces and the academic components, my team and I, because it's not alone. I have a strong team that does a lot of that work, and they specialize in their areas, and they help me navigate and work with the soup and coordinate all of our efforts. So it is, I'd love to say it's just one thing, but they're all of them together.
They're all of them together. And I think that's something I've heard across the board. And I think the really big struggle that I hear is that the demands are only increasing and the dollars are only decreasing.
I would agree.
And somehow you have to make it all happen. So
I would agree.
Wow. That's incredible. Okay. So one of the things that people have said about that they've loved about this conference, like a positivity, is that you have like the camaraderie and the community of other people who are leading large districts, urban districts, all the different kinds of districts. I would love to know, has there been one story that you've heard in the last couple of days that's really meant a lot to you?
Can't say there's one individual story.
Okay.
For me, and talked about it with some colleagues and people, and I'm gathering stuff to take back and share with the rest of my team and district leadership crew. It's a confluence of all of them.
What do you take back?
There's bits and pieces of tons of things. So I have a running document that has been collecting things that I've either QR codes, there's resources, there's PowerPoints, there's ideas and thoughts that, you know, I'm going to write out and just share with the team and say, hey, I know you're working with personalized learning for staff development.
Right.
Hey, I came across a resource and a person that had something that was really forward thinking. Here's something to consider and look at.
Right.
We're looking at fiscal resources and fiscal management. Sat at another session with some pretty forward thinking of how are we analyzing the return on investment of what we're doing? How are we looking at those components and making our decisions? So there's a whole host of different little nuggets that have been picked up across the board that I can't wait to share with the rest of my crew.
That's incredible. When you think about what you're walking away that's keeping you up at night, what's that look like?
Filtering through all the different things that are potential challenges.
Right.
And knowing that we have to prioritize a few of them to be able to get something that we can see tangible growth immediately.
Right.
Because the nature of it is, a lot of the work that we do is going to take 5 or 10 years to actually manifest itself into repeated, ongoing, monitored, and observed impact. But we don't have time for that. We
right.
have to have instantaneous results. We need to be able to, if we don't see the instantaneous results, help folks understand where their efforts day to day are creating forward progress so that by the end of the work, we can say you did the right thing. Because who wants to be at the end of giving your life, your soul, your energy,
right.
but not seeing anything on your work?
Right.
So it's understanding how can we break things down into manageable bite-sized pieces so that as our folks get into the grunt, do the work, hustle, work hard, that we can, as leaders, point out, hey, that's a win right there.
Right.
That's a win. The next phase will come here, helping them see the future. I mean, turning the light on at the end of the tunnel, because otherwise you're constantly running in the dark. And when you keep hitting doors that are open, that's not too fun.
Right. It's funny. I laugh as you said that because I cannot remember the last time I heard a teacher feel like someone put up their win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like teachers will tell you all day long, my losses are everywhere.
Correct.
But my wins, and so it's really lovely to have you say that, to say that like we got to be able to look and see where do we find the wins. Because I think what you really mentioned is really hard is kids can't wait 5 years for us to get better, right? And I'll tell you, I think it was the Fort Worth ISD, Soup told me earlier today, she said, you know, when you become the superintendent, they want better results now, but not for you to change anything.
Like, correct.
Somehow everything needs to stay the same, but also everything to get better.
Mm-hmm. All at the same time.
Wow.
That's why the nature of being a superintendent is sometimes it's a monumental task.
Right. All right. Tell me, well, let's put one of your wins up. What's an academic win from your district?
An academic win over the past couple of years, past 2 or 3 years specifically, we've seen our scores in our kindergarten, they're, let's say, on track performance scores growing consistently.
Right. Thanks for joining us on the More Than a Test podcast. If you found this conversation valuable, subscribe to our YouTube channel and find us on your favorite podcast platform. At Amira Learning, we believe every child deserves a chance to become a reader, and we're excited to be part of this conversation. See you next week, and thanks for joining.